guest was.
Sit down, son. Now, I don't care who you know and what you've raced, this is F1. This is the only place where if you win, you can claim you're the best in the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening to this podcast, you missed the greatest visual gag that I've ever done on a podcast.
I'm sure I can take you seriously in a Nomex suit, but we'll give it a good shot.
We'll break the suspense. I'm sitting here in a... Is this an actual race suit, Chris? What am I wearing?
Actual, this is the actual Apex GP Team F1 racing suit. Race-approved Nomex. You should get nice and warm in just a couple of minutes.
I am already cooking.
Do you want the gloves to go with that?
They're also nice and warm. Absolutely. You lose heat through your hands. I need to lose heat through my hands. I'm wearing a race suit. Was this actually worn in the movie?
Or? No, it's a replica of Sonny Hayes, Brad Pitt's character, a race suit. You see that Seven of Spades on the shoulder there, that signature racing logo. Well, it looks good on you.
Well, look, I'm not going to lie. It's a little short in the leg, and I'm going to unzip it now a little bit because it's quite warm. But look, this is the lengths we're going to in episode 4 of this mini-series.
Full immersion.
Full immersion. We've sort of teased it, but now we're going there. This is the episode where we're going to take you inside the suit of F1 the movie. No doubt you're excited about seeing it. If you've listened this far, you are definitely a candidate to watch this movie. Chris, we teased people at the end of the last episode with a bit of a riddle or a true-false. Is Chris Granger Air, the CEO of IWC, in the movie, F1 the movie? What is the answer?
Potentially. I haven't seen the movie yet, so I've shot
could
a walk-on.
Could be on the cutting room floor.
I've shot my cameo. I could definitely be on the couch at cutting room floor. I wouldn't be surprised. So, no, we'll have to wait till June 27th, but I'm cautiously optimistic.
Well, I have high hopes that you will make the final version. What can you tell me about what could be in the movie? Because what better way to set up this episode than talk about your scene?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it's a very good metaphor, I think, for this entire movie, because the blending of where actual F1 stops and the movie starts was really, really frighteningly seamless, right? I remember arriving in Abu Dhabi at the end of last season, getting out of the car at the W Hotel, as you do in Abu Dhabi, and I saw all these like typical paddock club VIPs, you know, as you know them from Formula One. I thought, it's Thursday. What are they all doing here? And obviously only to find out later on that they were in fact all actors and extras from the F1 movie that were there ready to populate the team hospitality. And that's really how convincing it is. So you get up there and there's about 250 actors there in this team hospitality in the grandstands, and convincing influencers, WAGs, VIPs, CEOs, you know, the works, you know, team hospitality, catering employees, barkeepers, and everything looks exactly like it does in Formula One. Like you couldn't tell the difference, right? And it started off, I was quite late to my walk-on part, and apparently it's me and a group of other people walking on. And the person next to me after the first take was like, oh, so what do you normally do? Do you in TV or Netflix? You know, what do you? And I said, no, I'm the actual CEO of right. And he's like, great costume. I was like, no, that's what I wear. I work in Formula One. This is not, you know, we have a full day of F1, so activation. This is just how, you know, it's, but that's how good they cast it, because any one of these actors you could have put into any of the motorhomes, any of the garages, and they would have looked perfectly like in place. There was nothing really that could tell that apart from the fact that all of this action went on, and then every so often, Joe Kosinski could say cut or direct somebody over the headset, and they would all move and behave according to his instructions. That's totally weird, because it's like reality manipulation. So it says, okay, can all the people in the back disappear? And then they're all gone. It's like, it's really weird. And you feel while you're in it that this whole thing is real. To the point that after a couple of hours, I walked over to one of the bars and I felt really thirsty. I said, could I just have a still water? And the guy looks at me and says, I'm not a barkeeper. This is a prop, not a bar. And I'm like, but, you know, you buy it 100%. And that, for me, is the magic of that particular movie.
Wow. And this is the part I can't get my head around. You didn't know what part this scene played in the bigger movie. You didn't know anything about your character's sort of I mean, beyond...
might be the villain.
Who knows? You could be the bad guy. No. But how does that work? What were your instructions?
I have to say, it's partly my fault because when we had the script in the beginning, I never read the full script, like due to timing reasons. So I probably would have understood more had I read the script. But because that happens quite late and it's obviously purely at the director's discretion to say, is there a part where somebody can appear in the background? And apparently there's a few people I know of that have had this opportunity. So you don't know when it's going to be, how timelines are going to align, schedules are going to align. So in the end, it's like, oh, you come to Abu Dhabi. Oh, on the Thursday, there might be a scene where we could be doing it. So you don't know a lot apart from, okay, it's in hospitality, wear your normal stuff, turn up at 11:30, and then we take it from there. So literally, I literally walked on. They were like, okay, go that way and say hi and say cheers, grab a drink, and we'll see the rest.
So the movie will resolve your questions about whether you're going to be in a Hollywood movie, and it's not far away. But before we get more into the movie and what else we can tell from behind the scenes of this movie that's neither of us have seen.
Yeah.
And I truly didn't believe you the first time you told me that you hadn't seen it, but now I do. What are we wearing and why did you freak out when that one appeared? I'm going to start with mine. I have the pistachio and gold ingenieur. And you have something that looks similar if I squint. So but this,
it's an 1832 engineer, historic watch from 1976, slightly modified for the movie. So this has quite a unique backstory. So basically, as we're starting the production work on F1 the movie, I got an email out of the blue from somebody identifying as BP. And I basically ignored it. I get a lot of mails like that. And a couple of days later, I think my PR team said to me, did you get an email from Brad Pitt? And I was like, check. So I went back to it. And indeed, yes, it sounded quite believable. And somebody saying, look, I'm playing this role in this new movie. And what I'm looking for really is an original Giro Argenta Ingenieur, 1832 jumbo automatic. But I'd like it to be in my unique finishing. And I'd like it to be half as thick as the original is. And I was like, whoa, wow, that's, first of all, very impressive, the level of detail knowledge on really the dimensions of our watches. And then the second thing was like, oh gosh, how are we going to accomplish that? How am I going to make an original 1976 watch a lot thinner, as you can see, because it's quite the original is quite a beast.
It is.
And this was where my technical team came in, and I talked to Stefanin. And I said, look, what could we possibly do? And I think the solution in the end was really that we took out the anti-magnetic soft iron in a cage. We drilled out that entire case back construction and inserted a new container and then put a new ultra-flat case back onto the existing movement. And that obviously meant that the watch is probably not anti-magnetic or waterproof anymore. But we did manage to reduce the height quite a bit. And then that watch went very uniquely to a watch customizer in New York called Closter Watch, who's done work on watches before. And he created that unique polishing and brushing finish on that watch and created a dial. And the idea was that we match the dial to Sunny Hayes racing color in the movie, which is actually that jade green that we can see here in the helmet. And the Closter Watch did a couple of prototypes. And I think when they were first examined, Brad wasn't very keen on the result in that actual color, but there was a backup color made, which was this, you call it pistachio or racing green, moss green, whatever you want to call it. And that obviously was received really, really positively. And that's made that last minute switch to actually that color for the movie watch. And that's then ultimately the watches that we used on set. And this is then also the color we were able to license and that you see in that beautiful Ingenieur Automatic 40mm now and that unique green with the gold accent in the indices that we are now offering in a limited edition of 1,000 pieces.
Now, look, quick little side question and side mission for you listening. What is your favorite Ingenieur of the new models? Because I found that the blue was my favorite in the second wave, which was an interesting choice. I still find that, I'll forever find that an interesting choice to leave the blue until the second wave, because the first was black, it was silver, there was the
Aqua.
But blue was held back, and then that became everyone. That's a classic Ingenieur. And then this sage or pistachio came out, and it is just so easily my favorite. Yeah. But I'm curious to know what's yours.
So the original lineup, by the way, was blue all the way to the very last minute. So it was black, the silver, and the blue.
Yes.
And I had late prototypes of the aqua dial coming in. in the context of another watch we made within Portuguesa for somebody else that we talked about in a previous episode. And that color on the Ingenieur, I liked the sample dial of a lot. And I had it put into an Ingenieur. Then I played around. I had actually one side with the polished center links and another side on the completely brushed center links and brushed bracelet. And I started to wear this for 3-4 days around the office. And I loved the aqua color a lot. I loved what it did to the watch. I loved that it was not a straightforward sports blue. And in the end, I sort of went back to the team and said, I know you're all going to hate me for this, but we'll change the blue for the aqua in the launch lineup. And that's how the aqua came in. And that's why the blue wasn't there in the beginning and why blue came in wave one, just before then the perpetual calendar came to complement the blue.
Now, it is a very slim Ingenieur. And when you do go back and find those original models, you know, the automatic models were quite thick. What was Brad's reasoning, do you think, in wanting a slimmer model? Was it just for the ergonomics of the wax?
It's 100% ergonomics. And I think this is something we did on the Ingenieur 40 quite actively, that I always try to design the new Ingenieurs from the outside in. So I'm looking at a finished result and a finished look and feel for these watches. And then we make the construction and the engineering achieve that result. It's not like, oh, here's an anti-magnetic watch and, oh, sorry, it's going to be 15 millimeters thick and 46 millimeter diameter. We're really trying to say, this is the final wearable result that we're looking for. We do that in rapid prototyping and then we engineer it backwards. And here, for example, the Ingenieur 40, that connecting center link to the case, I think took 14 or 15 engineering iterations until we had something where the gapping is right, where the resistance against overbending is right, where the integration worked, where the polishing worked. You know, it's tricky to get to a simple result. And this is always what we're aiming for. Like in the end, the Ingenieur, I want to keep the Ingenieur quite simple, but put everything into the engineering ergonomics to make sure that it wears like it does.
I do want to continue that line of questioning about the Ingenieur, because the promo video you did for this watch was extraordinary. I feel it's becoming a part of IWC's DNA to have this cinematic aspect. But tell me about this particular movie, because that looked like a big product, big project.
Yeah. No, look, we're really lucky that the Gerald Genta Heritage Foundation and Gerald Genta's widow, Evelyn, and her daughter were really, really, really supportive from the get-go with the whole Ingenieur project. And obviously the archive material we had on Gerald Genta's original designs are quite limited, but Evelyn did a beautiful search for us. She really went into all the detail and one of the design drawings that we launched with the Ingenieur Automatic 40 was really resurrected from the archive just specifically for that project. And we worked very closely together. And I think for them also, it's really nice to see her husband, her father celebrated in this way. And you see also at the end of the promo video, it says, with thank you to the, you know, Gerald Genta Heritage Foundation. And we're really, really grateful for all the support they've given us throughout. And then we went basically with the same director as we used for our Born of a Dream heritage film that documents IWC's founding story.
Is that James Marsden?
No, James Marsden was the actor in it, along with Tom Brady in the second part. But Horner, who's the director, he did Born of a Dream, which was that cinematic storytelling of the F.A. Jones founding story, and now the Gerald Genta Almost Brilliant Failure film, which follows a similar sort of, you know, it's overlaying, like in the Born of a Dream movie, it was the overlaying of the Civil War story that Jones was exposed to serving in the military, and his business success and failure as a startup watch entrepreneur in Schaffhausen. And in Almost Brilliant Failure, you have that overlaying of the racing history of that fictional race driver. What was his name? I can't remember. But anyway, a fictional racing driver. And the Gerald Genta launch success or not. And you could see that basically the racing driver's crash sort of coincides with the moment when we realize nobody's buying this new Ingenieur. The engineers are not biting. They're not buying it.
I just love that it's
ultimately
it's
being shelved.
Brilliant failure. I love that the
Rocco del Sante, Tania. That was the one I looked for. Our fictional Italian racing driver.
It's kind of, there's no happy ending to this promo. It's celebrated for what it was. And yet, of course, the sheer reemergence is kind of the happy ending.
The story started for me in realizing that despite the gravitas and the weight of the original Genta Ingenieur, which was one of the three major steel sports watches being launched in 1975 and 1976, that over the period of 25 or odd years, there's only about 500 ever manufactured, which seems bizarre by today's standards, right? And the fact that you have such a design icon that is so rarefied that it must have been a complete and utter flop originally or not promoted to the right target audience. And that then in the end almost makes it beautiful because it becomes an original Genta design without the cultural connotations that come with 45, 50 years of design development and it being worn out in the wild. You really have like almost a blank slate.
It's a capsule, time capsule.
It's a time capsule. Right? Yeah. And that's, I think, why we wanted to showcase it in that way, that maybe it was just ahead of its time that a watch being marketed to engineers when everybody else marketed their watches to the jet set high-flying stars and starlets of the 1970s probably was a bit, you know, off cultural zeitgeist at the time, but is so much more relevant today. And yeah, here we are.
And there are two things I want to talk about here, because the reason this little mini series, which is drawing to a close with this episode, has been so fun for me, is that at every twist and turn, Time and Tide or me as a person have been in there, part of the story.
Yeah.
Whether it's talking about post that we did that broke the news, or whether it's me sitting next to Evelyn, sitting next to you, and me dealing with the incredibly daunting task of speaking to this incredible woman who is just the sharpest person.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She's.
I remember sitting in her office in the Monegasque Embassy, London.
She's frightening because she's so formidable. She's absolutely incredible. Yes. So we're there in that part of the story, and I think that relaunching the Ingenieur was an incredible education in the fact that things are never over.
Mm.
You know, something like this watch can be, and I think in that moment on About Effing Time, I expected that was sort of the re-peak.
Mm.
But what we have now and what we're on the brink of now is another height, which is the Ingenieur supplanted back into the most popular sport at its most popular time on potentially the most popular male actor of our generation.
Mm.
So the watch has found its way from obscurity to wonderful heights on About Effing Time. Yeah. I mean, does it get any better? And now,
clearly not.
to a second
now
rate.
Now we have About Effing Time in a race suit. So
it all comes together.
It all comes together. Yeah.
But no, now it finds itself well and truly part of the cultural conversation on Brad Pitt's wrist. I wonder though, when you get a request like that from a movie star, hey, can you just make it thinner? And I don't care how you do it. It doesn't matter. Just get it done. Like, you guys are such precise engineers and you're so meticulous in the way you craft things. Like, isn't that just sort of the nightmare assignment to just
not
sort
all,
of make it okay?
This is why I come in, you know, because the background in interior design, you know how to fix things last minute, right? You know, there's always, there's planned beautiful designs in engineering, but then there's also, you know, makeshift bricolage last minute. It's also part of the job. Now, you know, obviously this is something I really enjoy because you're right, you know, to our engineers and watchmakers and designers, this is kind of a nightmare to do stuff in 72 hours and to in a sense not do a proper job. But I like the challenge of creating the end result with very limited means in very short amount of time, similar to that stopwatch on Top Gun Maverick. This was a similar kind of challenge where I love the conversation then with my technical director, because he will think in the dimensions of a technical director in terms of solutions, and I will think about sort of a hobby basement kind of workbench approach to stuff and say, why don't we just, you know, make a rapid proto 3D plastic part that we 3D print that we can insert into the case that can hold the movement. And like, my technical director would look at me like, are you insane in one of our watches? You know, and I think the middle ground where you meet each other and you meet the timeline and you meet the required result, it's fun. And it's always the case for Hollywood. It's always been the case for many of the military projects. It's always the case for things that go into space. You know, the timelines are tight. The requirements are out of our comfort zone. And that sometimes it's an interesting challenge.
Now, I had a question in here about other integrations in movies. Mm. And I've since learned that there hasn't been nothing really on the scale of Maverick and F1 the movie before. This is just for people that spot IWCs in movies in general.
Yeah.
What's the difference between the way that the brand has sort of interacted with F1 the movie versus all the other places we see IWC?
Yeah.
Because as eagle-eyed watch spotters, we love to pick them out in movies. Yeah.
No, I think the journey started for me, the movie journey, really with Jurassic World in 2015. So in Jurassic World, we had a producer who apparently was a fan of IWC, and we had this opportunity in that shopping mall that makes up the high street of the Jurassic World Park, with the Samsung Innovation Center at one end and the infamous lagoon on the other end. And I said, why don't you do an IWC boutique there? And, you know, the Sumi architect, I was like, yeah, but I think there's only one person who can merchandise it, and that is me. So off I went. This was actually set up in the Six Flags car park in New Orleans, a huge outdoor set, really impressive. Again, that all been built for real, and there was Brookstones and Margaritavilles and Ben & Jerry's and all of these different brands, boutiques. Pandora next to us, a special dinosaur-inspired Starbucks. There's a Starbucks with a huge, like, dinosaur wallpaper and everything being dinosaur decorated. And again, the level of detail blew me away. They had everything from the cups to the straws to everything was perfect. You know, Ben & Jerry's merchandise, A to Z. So we set up this full IWC boutique with the outdoor clock, with two facades to it, etc. And you can actually see it in the end fight between Tyrannosaurus Rex and Indominus Rex. You have that IWC boutique, right? Your eagle-eyed watch spotters will see it. If they pause the DVD or the streaming video, they'll see it. So that was my first experience. But it was a non-promotion embedding of a boutique into the background of a movie. Then Top Gun Maverick was really a classic watch placement in a movie, where it was all down to watch placement and visibility within the movie. And then F1, the movie, goes one step further because we're team sponsors. So the entire branding world of IWC is really fully integrated into the movie. And that extension of Mercedes-Benz and IWC goes straight into that Apex GP team. And you see the driver's suits on the helmets, the cars, the paddock, the wall clocks in the garages. Everywhere you go, you'll find that sponsorship integration, and then also the promotion that comes on the back of it. So that's a completely different type of partnership compared to Top Gun Maverick or compared to Jurassic World.
So the movie's coming up. Do you expect, from a hard-nosed business perspective, to see a bump from so much IWC? Like, this
very
movie,
much hope so.
More than a bump.
It's a forward-looking statement. I think
a spike. But no, is there, because I suppose, how do you judge success from this integration? Is it simply the alignment? Does the movie have to win awards? Like, what are the measures for success?
Look, the thing about our business is that in this sort of very emotionally driven purchase process that is a mechanical watch, where you know this from yourself, your influences are where you see it, who has it, what your friends say, what advertising you see, what you consume on social media, what movie you may have seen, and every person resonates with something completely different. We often say it probably takes more than 10, 15 contact points between a customer and the brand to finally get to that point where you say, not only, oh, I like it, I like their watches, but I'm going to go and buy one, right? And I think this correlation in our business between what exact moment is that moment that does it for one individual person, it's impossible to tell. I think what we can look at and what we can improve all of the time is, how do we communicate, on which channel, what stories do we tell, and hopefully create a package that overall is compelling. But, you know, it never, in our world of marketing, it never comes to this kind of idea, or I do this and that will have exactly that effect. I think the environment of what triggers you, and you know this from your own purchasing behavior, is just too complex to really nail this down. But would we like to see a spike? Always.
Chris, I feel like that wraps it up. I feel like we have really captured the world of IWC and Formula One. And interestingly, it's only a 12-year little sphere of time. And I feel that in that time, the sport has just completely exploded.
Yep.
And this year, definitely, that you know, like we talked about when we discussed the changes, when you asked how different Melbourne was, it was the teenage girls that are now obsessed with the drivers, because they're seeing the drivers on TV. Culturally, demographically, everything is in this incredible sort of zeitgeist right now. So I have totally loved the sort of enriching the dimensionality that we've put around this partnership and this world. I can't wait to see the movie. I now, just so you know, I do believe you that you haven't seen it. I know that would be a contractually bound NDA, but I do believe that we are both in the same boat. I have not seen this movie. And I hope that this experience for you listening has made you want to either rush out and see it in the movies, or to stream it, or wherever you are and whatever point in time. I hope that this has had that effect, and I hope that it has helped you understand the authentic and to me, very compelling connection between IWC and Formula One.
And to the point of you saying like 12 years doesn't feel very long, when I look at the lineup of all of the livery cars in the Mercedes team that carried the IWC on the front wing end plate, you know, we're now almost up to 50% of Mercedes' time in Formula One in history.
Wow.
Which is because there was obviously that big gap. And then suddenly, like, it strikes me because I remember my first Melbourne GP in 2018, I think it was, I put the very first IWC logo sticker on the very first car myself in the garage. I actually took it off the poor intern that actually had the job because these deals are discussed so last minute. You know, often the sponsors are not on the cars yet 20 hours before they actually go out, right? So we had the IWC stickers made and I was in the back of the garage putting the first sticker on. And you think, you look at all the lineup now for all the seasons and world championships, I think it's almost 50% of the history. And as part of that livery, it just gives me a bit of goosebumps, definitely. It's nice to see.
And what I think draws this whole thing to a close is that I was at that Grand Prix.
You were, yes.
Melbourne is my home city. And to think that, you know, again, there's all these ways that the story has crisscrossed and overlapped, and we've been at many of the moments together that we've talked about. So I thank you for being so candid and for sharing these stories with us. And, yeah, I can't wait for this movie.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you. It's great to dive into these stories, often, you know, only remembering them there and then. And yeah, looking forward to many more intersections of our stories as we go forward.
Indeed. I just can't wait to get out of this fire suit now. Thanks very much.
No makes us hot.